Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Friday the 13th of March, these are our main stories. From total lockdown to gentle advice for citizens, how different countries approach the spread of the coronavirus. Are US sanctions hampering efforts to fight the spread of the virus in Iran, as the government in Tehran claims? And why a mission to Mars had to be postponed for more than 2 years, partly due to the pandemic? Also in this podcast, how is life for Nigerians who returned from South Africa after violent attacks on foreigners there?
I miss my school. Also, I miss many of my friends there. I miss many of my teachers. I wasn't able to say goodbye to them.
And under observation, Germany's domestic intelligence service has a group within the far-right Alternative for Germany in its sights. The coronavirus lockdown in Europe, which began in Italy this week, is spreading. Slovakia is closing borders to non-citizens, and the Czech Republic is now in a state of emergency. It's banning people from 15 nations deemed to be at high risk from entering the country. Theatres, music performances, films and sports events are all postponed until the end of the month. The increase in so-called social distancing measures is not restricted to Europe. The president of the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte, says there will be a halt to all transport in and out of the capital, Manila. He also approved a month of school closures, the 22nd country around the world to do so. These kinds of measures are not being taken everywhere, of course. Here in Britain, the Prime Minister held a meeting of the government's emergency committee, known as COBRA, on Thursday afternoon. No dramatic changes were announced there, but Boris Johnson did outline the latest official advice.
From tomorrow, if you have coronavirus symptoms, however mild, either a new continuous cough or a high temperature, then you should stay at home for at least 7 days to protect others and help slow the spread of the disease. We advise all those over 70 with serious medical conditions against going on cruises, and we advise against international school trips. At some point in the next few weeks, we are likely to go further, and if someone in a household has those symptoms, we will be asking everyone in that household to stay at home.
Well, that approach is very different from Italy's, where the government has imposed a strict nationwide lockdown, ordering all non-essential shops and services to close. Italy's foreign minister, Luigi Di Maio, has defended his country's position.
I can tell other countries in the world that there is a way to defeat this virus. On this, Italy is available to share all the information needed. The model that is working is that of the red zones that we created in the first 10 towns in Lombardy. 2 weeks since they went into lockdown, they have zero infection rates. Then we extended those rules to the whole of Italy.
So, why the difference in approach? I got the views of two of our reporters, Seema Katecha in Italy and Rob Watson here in London. I began by asking Rob, what did come out of the latest meeting here in Britain?
I've got three quick takeaways. The first is the general strategy is to move from containment to delay. So they're accepting you can't stop the virus spreading throughout the population, but you just want to slow that down. And the main way in which they're going to be doing that at this stage is to say, if you've got coronavirus-like symptoms, self-isolate, stay at home for 7 days. The second thing that struck me was the change of tone from the Prime Minister. This incredible gravity of the situation. I think he said, you know, this was the biggest health issue in a generation. And there was a very somber moment where he said, look, people are going to die. Families are going to lose people ahead of their time. And then the third thing in terms of the way in which the UK is moving at a different pace, that was when the chief scientific advisor came in and said, look, we're probably about 4 weeks behind where Italy is in terms of where the virus is, where the epidemic is in the UK.
Seema, in Italy, are the Italian people fully behind this now that we're a day and a half into this full lockdown?
Well, Prime Minister Conte's approval ratings have gone up since he's put these stringent measures in place. Just to remind you what those measures are, all schools and universities closed, museums, cinemas, We found out yesterday evening that he was also saying that shops were going to close from today, all shops apart from pharmacies and supermarkets. So it's incredibly quiet where I am. I'm in Rome, one of the most popular tourist destinations in the world. You would not think that now, walking through the streets. It's eerily quiet. It's actually quite haunting. And people actually, the ones that I do meet, say they don't know what to do. They feel a real sense of trepidation. There is nervousness. There is anxiety. But a lot of them do have faith, and they feel that this will, in the end, Italy is a pugnacious country, I was told, and they do feel that the country will get through and that the correct measures have been put in place to curb this deadly outbreak that is taking hundreds of lives in this country every day.
Rob Watson here in the studio. That isn't happening so far here in the UK, but Boris Johnson did leave the door open to take more stringent measures, didn't he?
Very much so, because the government thinks that the peak of this disease in the UK is probably going to come sometime perhaps in April or in May. And so they're keeping some of their powder dry, if you like. But absolutely, they're talking about perhaps you could get to a point where even if only one person in the family is showing symptoms, everybody else would have to self-isolate. And I think there's also a focus clearly on advice to the elderly, as seen as being by far and away the most vulnerable and those with underlying conditions.
So, would it be better if there was a unified global response? And if so, why isn't the World Health Organization being prescriptive about what that should be? Philippa Roxby is our health correspondent.
The argument is that every country is at a slightly different stage of an epidemic. And the numbers of cases in each country are slightly different. So Italy's experience is different from France's experience, which is different to the UK experience, which is different to the Chinese experience. In the UK, medical experts are absolutely certain that now is not the right time to make drastic changes to society. Things like closing schools, shutting down flights, stopping people from travelling. They say it's way too early to do that for the UK epidemic. In Italy, something very different happened. Their cases rose very, very sharply. Their hospitals were inundated with seriously ill people and they had to do something quickly. But the experience in other countries might be slightly different.
Yeah, I mean, quite a lot of countries with very small numbers of people infected are taking what seems to be quite drastic action.
Like Ireland today, for example, I think they only have had one death, but they're closing schools. Same in the Czech Republic, I hear as well. Some countries would say that could be a slight overreaction. Maybe they feel under pressure to do it because other countries are doing it. Countries like the UK feel they want to stand strong. They feel that they know what's best for their population and they don't want to go too hard, too quickly. The argument is that you need to wait for that peak to come and then have a short, sharp shock where people are perhaps asked to stay at home for a couple of weeks or more than that, and people get bored. They lose incentive, they can't see the point of it, and it doesn't work.
And yet all behind this, the WHO yesterday was saying, we call on every government to step up and scale up their efforts. I suppose that's open to interpretation, isn't it?
Yeah.
And people interpret those kind of words in a different way.
That's right. I mean, you could interpret that as a call to action for everybody. And there are some countries who have made big, drastic changes to their policies, probably based on that WHO statement yesterday. It remains to be seen whose tactics are best. The WHO said nobody's got it 100% right, nobody's got it wrong either. Each individual nation has got to decide what's best for them.
Yeah, you use that phrase, it remains to be seen. It will be analysed when all this is over for the next time.
Yeah, absolutely. People will want to know exactly how this pans out. It'll be so interesting to see if countries can get over the peak, their individual peaks, and down the other side and recover from it, so that in time we have a vaccine and people develop immunity and this becomes something we don't have to talk about day in, day out.
Philippa Roxby. Well, Iran is one of the countries worst hit by coronavirus, with more than 10,000 infections and around 430 deaths. Officials there are now asking for a loan from the International Monetary Fund, and they say that US sanctions are hampering their efforts to combat the crisis. Behram Abbasi is from the BBC's Persian service.
The Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif has written a letter to the UN Secretary General and has said that all the sanctions have to be lifted because Iranian medical personnel face severe shortages of medical equipment and medicine. He's also posted a picture of a list he sent to the UN Secretary General, a list of the equipment Iran needs, including ventilators and masks and protective gear. And basically, he's implying that the US sanctions have made it impossible for Iranian medical staff to access these equipment and also medicine. But in response, not particularly to this request, but prior to this, the United States has always said that its sanctions do not target medicine in Iran and that it's offered to help Iran deal with the outbreak, but Iran has refused the United States offer.
So to what extent are hospitals and the medical system as a whole struggling with regards to this outbreak?
It seems to be a huge crisis in Iran at the moment. The virus has spread to all provinces and some local authorities are saying that they're already running out of beds and they need to set up makeshift hospitals. So at the moment, they are struggling a lot to deal with the huge number of people wanting to get tested, showing some results, and there are also reports that only people who are in critical condition are being tested at the moment. And if they pass away before the results of the test are out or they are even tested, they are not included in the official tally of those having died of the coronavirus. The problem is that Iran did not place any cities under quarantine. The virus first emerged in one city and it quickly spread to other provinces in the country. And officials are still very insistent that no cities are being placed under quarantine. And the problem is that in over a week's time, we are getting to Nowruz holidays, the new Iranian New Year. And we have traditionally 2 weeks of holidays. It's the time people are going to travel. But authorities, although they're asking people not to travel, they're not imposing any sort of restrictions. They're just expecting people to stay at home. Universities and schools are closed, of course, but the government, as the biggest employer in the country, has not closed down public offices. Businesses are open, public transport is still running, but people are asked to stay at home.
So what's life like for an ordinary Iranian at the moment in terms of the restrictions on their everyday life?
A lot of people who can afford it have self-isolated. They're staying at home. They're really careful, trying to sanitize everything, wash their hands and, you know, follow up all the guidelines. Schools are closed, so students are staying at home. But those who are going to work, they have a lot of concerns about, you know, getting the virus on public transport. You see pictures of them in packed buses, underground, everyone wearing masks, but they're still really worried about, you know, the situation.
That was Baran Abbasi of BBC Persian. The tourism sector worldwide has already been severely hit by the pandemic. And for small islands like Zanzibar, heavily dependent on visitors for its foreign income, it's feared that the impact is going to be especially hard felt. As Sami Awami reports, the Tanzanian government is now looking at boosting investment in other sectors to mitigate the economic blow.
Beautiful beaches, warm weather and welcoming people. Zanzibar's postcard scenery and rich historical culture bring close to 500,000 tourists to this island every year. But there have been some changes recently, which are quite noticeable in certain parts of the capital, Stone Town. I am walking along a sidewalk with a beautiful ocean view of the calm sea on my right-hand side and promenade dotted with tall palm trees on my left-hand side. This sidewalk is usually bustling with tourists, but I'm told in the last few days it has become much quieter. Many here fear that this could be part of a slowing down in tourism that this island expects.
The outbreak of the coronavirus has affected our businesses very much.
Yusuf Njama is a tour guide operator based in Zanzibar's capital, Stone Town. Anecdotally, he thinks the virus is having a marked impact on those vital tourism numbers.
It has cut down the number of tourists coming here, especially after the cancellation of direct flights from Italy.
As the global death toll from the virus has risen, employers have been discouraging their employees from travelling and many holidaymakers are choosing to stay home. Several hotels here in Zanzibar have already received cancellations, especially from group bookings. Abdulaziz Yusuf is the manager at the Tembo Hotel.
In Zanzibar, it's going to affect us a lot because Zanzibar, really, we are relying on tourism now. So it's an Italian market, it's a big market on the other end. But in general, tourism is a backbone of Zanzibar also. So we are going to lose a lot.
The numbers are stark. Financing for at least 60% of the island's budget comes from tourism sector. Authorities here are under pressure to mitigate the losses to the crucial businesses and in the long term to diversify Zanzibar's sources of income. First, though, they are trying to stop the virus from getting onto the island in the first place. Hamad Rashid is Zanzibar's health minister.
We've been very careful in stopping people to come to Zanzibar. We've been very, very careful.
And how do you see this outbreak affecting, you know, local tourism industry here and consequently Zanzibar's economy? Because now you've cancelled flights and probably there are fewer and fewer people who are willing to travel.
Well, it's not only Zanzibar economy, but if you see now, there's a big recession in the world is going to happen. So it directly, whether we have tourists, we don't have tourists, is going to affect us. We have to improve our fishing industry now, not depend on the tourism anymore because of this risk which may happen any time.
I'm at Zanzibar's ferry port. It's a small one, but can get quite busy, especially when your passenger ferry docks from the mainland. I can see here at immigration there's temperature screening going on.
Luckily for this island, they have only this port and an airport to focus on its efforts to restrict the importation of coronavirus. Health Minister Hamad Rashid tells me other efforts they have in place to fight coronavirus.
We have 192 primary health care centres whereby we have people there. We trained our people to look all the symptoms and so on and so forth. So it's a small area, very easy to control because it's a small area.
Exactly how easy will be seen in the days and weeks ahead. Authorities and businesses here are holding on the hope that, in the short term at least, Zanzibar's beautiful scenery and natural bounties will trump fears of the coronavirus or perhaps avoid the virus altogether.
That was Sami Awami in Zanzibar. And just to remind you, the BBC World Service is bringing you a daily roundup on the spread and implications of coronavirus, with reports from affected areas and the latest medical information too. So to hear what the global effects are on health, business, sport and travel, go to bbcworldservice.com for the coronavirus global update. The European Union and Russia have decided to postpone a joint mission to send a rover to Mars. Engineers have said there are just too many tasks outstanding to launch as planned in a few months' time, particularly in the light of the coronavirus crisis. The mission is now expected to launch in 2022. Our science correspondent Jonathan Amos has been following the latest developments.
They have a rover that's supposed to be launching to the Red Planet in July, August this year. It's actually called Rosalind Franklin after the famous DNA pioneer in the UK from the 1950s, late 1940s. And they were struggling, it has to be said, to meet the launch deadline this summer. You can only go to Mars every 26 months when the planets are aligned. If you try and launch any other time, you just won't reach your destination. So you go when Earth and Mars are coming close together. And then by the time you arrive in that spot where Mars is, it's there and you can land. So it was a hard deadline. And unfortunately, what they found is that the engineering tasks that they need to complete to get that rover to the launch pad in time are simply too great. And then, of course, you add in the global coronavirus crisis. I mean, just to give you one example of the impact that it will be having on not just this mission, but other space missions as well. The headquarters for this project is in Turin, in Italy, and Italy is currently in lockdown. So even if they didn't have these other problems that they had, the virus is certainly going to complicate matters for not just this project, but others that European space and Russian space are involved in. So the next opportunity will be in late 2022. And the time it takes to get to Mars means you will land in early middle part of 23. So we've got a bit of time to go yet.
Jonathan Amos. Still to come on this podcast, how threatening is the internet for women? The inventor of the World Wide Web warns that women and girls face a growing crisis of harm online. Kenya says an investigation has begun into allegations that blood that's been donated by Kenyans is being smuggled to Somalia. The country's blood transfusion service is at the centre of this inquiry. I've been speaking to our Africa regional editor, Will Ross.
They're basically saying that they're aware that there is a problem, and they know that some of the blood that's donated by Kenyans is being stolen and then sold to the hospitals rather than being provided to the hospitals. And they know that it's going on, but this is the first time they've actually admitted it, because some information leaked out that this investigation was underway involving the Directorate of Criminal Investigations. So then the health minister came out, Mutahi Kagwe, and said, yes, we are looking into it. And yes, there have been some reports that some of this blood is also making its way to Somalia through what sounds like really a sort of a cartel or some kind of a scheme involving clearly some people in Kenya's National Blood Transfusion Service, but also there must be people in the different hospitals involved, as well as people, if indeed this blood is getting to Somalia, as well as people in clinics or, you know, medical people in Somalia.
And do we know how widespread this is and how much blood this entails?
We don't know that yet, but what's happened over the last few months is that the shortage of blood in Kenya has increased. There's a real problem. Basically, last year, they were looking to try and get 500,000 units of blood from ordinary people, just asking them to come and donate, and they ended up with less than a quarter of that figure. So they've got a shortage, and that then leads to when somebody's in hospital, they need blood. It's often their relatives or their family that then puts out an appeal and says, has anybody got this type of blood? We urgently need it. Of course, if the system worked properly, the blood bank would have all that resource there, and they wouldn't have the patients and their relatives and family literally pleading with people to get the blood. So it is a crisis, and it's been exacerbated by the fact that funding, a huge amount of funding, came from the United States government for about 15 years to fund this National Blood Transfusion Service, and that ended recently. And people are saying that there is a correlation between this funding that's ended and now it's all, you know, becoming a bit of a shambles. And that's why the whole system has got quite a lot more rot in it. There's less accountability going on and these problems have emerged.
Will Ross. Germany's domestic intelligence service is putting part of the far-right Alternative for Germany party under surveillance, describing it as a threat to the democratic order. The move targets the AfD faction, especially strong in eastern Germany. Here's Mike Sanders.
They call the faction the Flügel, or the Wing. It's widely regarded as the most extreme element of Alternative for Germany, the AfD for short, which began life 7 years ago as a Eurosceptic campaign on economic issues. But the AfD's focus shifted to migration after the influx of 2015. The Flügel embodies the most strident voices, people such as Björn Höcke, the AfD leader in Thuringia, who's been branded a Nazi by a mainstream conservative rival. The intelligence agency said early last year that the Flügel was under suspicion for promoting discrimination against migrants, especially Muslims. Putting it under surveillance ramps up the pressure on it.
Mike Sanders. The inventor of the World Wide Web has warned that women and girls face a growing crisis of harm online. Tim Berners-Lee said sexual harassment and discrimination were making it a threatening place to be. Zoe Kleiman is our technology reporter.
I think he is highlighting on this 31st birthday of the web that although, you know, there have clearly been many benefits, that this trend of online abuse he describes as being dangerous. You know, he has an organisation called the Web Foundation, which surveyed young women and said 52% of them faced violence and threats online, and something like 87% of them thought things were getting worse. Part of that, of course, is just the sheer volume. You know, the more people there are using the internet and being online, the more likely you are for this harmful stuff to be happening from people who otherwise perhaps would have, you know, traditionally spoken amongst themselves or been in smaller groups. So what the internet's done is given a very powerful voice to individuals. And unfortunately, it's not always positive.
And what are the areas that are being seen as in need of attention?
So in his open letter, he lays out three priorities. He says the first one is we've got to close this digital divide, which is particularly affecting women. And that is that lack of access to the web, either because it's expensive and they can't afford the kit that's required, or that the kit just isn't accessible and available, or that they don't have the skills to use it. So the first is to make sure that everybody who wants it has access to the internet in the first place. The second, of course, is online safety. And that is making sure that people feel able to use the net and to get from it what they want without fear. And the third, and this is a really interesting thing, I think, he talks about bad algorithms and bad artificial intelligence. And this is, you know, things like bots, which are automatically picking up misinformation and picking up perhaps harmful threats and amplifying them by spreading them, by repeating them over and over again all over the net so that they gain even more momentum than they might have had before.
Zoe Kleinman. About 6 months ago, hundreds of Nigerians voluntarily returned home following deadly xenophobic attacks on foreigners in South Africa. Many of them had moved to South Africa in the hope of a better life, but most of them returned home empty-handed, having lost their properties during the clashes. Sam Olokoya has been finding out how they've been faring since they returned to Nigeria.
Thirteen-year-old Onyekasola Ogunfolaji sings one of her favorite South African songs. Singing the song reminds her of the good times in South Africa.
I miss my school. Also, I miss many of my friends there. I miss many of my teachers. I wasn't able to say goodbye to them. It was just sudden. I didn't really expect it. My dad just told me, you are going to Nigeria. I just burst into tears and I did not want to come back home because I'm not used to this place. I was used to South Africa.
In Oderemo town, Adejoke Beckley and her children reflect on life in South Africa. Mrs. Beckley says the family is living through hard times in Nigeria because they lost all they had in South Africa. She, however, says she and her children are happy to be in Nigeria because they were almost killed in South Africa.
I don't like South Africa because there is a lot of shooting and killing. That's what my kids used to say. So because they are no longer in that environment, they are happy.
Like the Beckley family, many other families lost all they had before fleeing to Nigeria. Motunrayo Olawole's shop was looted while her husband, who is a car dealer, lost all his vehicles. She says from a successful businesswoman in South Africa, she's now living in poverty in Nigeria. Since she arrived, her children have not attended school due to financial constraints.
To me, I prefer South Africa that year. Because I can see both sides now. I see here, I see South Africa. To me, that's why I say South Africa is better than here for me. A lot of things I'm facing here is very, very tough for me.
Olawole says when she arrived in Nigeria from South Africa, government representatives gave her about $100 in local currency. She says since then, she has been undergoing a lot of hardship and she's now trying to get money to return to South Africa with her children.
I don't want to stay in Nigeria at all. I would like to go back to South Africa. I love it.
And despite earlier promises of assistance from the Nigerian government, the families say they have received no support so far. Back in Oderemo town, a water tanker pumps water into a tank outside Mrs. Beckley's apartment. The apartment lacks running water, while electricity supply is very irregular. Her eldest daughter, Adediwura, says one of their main problems since returning to Nigeria is the absence of the kind of infrastructure they were used to.
I miss South Africa. Good road, electricity, stable electricity. The transportation when I was going to school, I used to use a bus. It was very nice. It's fancy. Nigeria. I remember the first day we were on the road in Nigeria, Ashley and Nire were shouting, the car is going to fall because the roads were boom, 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 potholes everywhere. It was bad. But Nigeria is fine. I've been coping fine. I've been coping well. It's still my fatherland. It's still Nigeria.
Thirteen-year-old Adediwura spent most of her life in South Africa. She used to sing the South African national anthem, seeing herself as a South African. But the xenophobic attacks against foreigners now make her believe that not everyone is wanted there.
That report by Sam Olukoya in Nigeria. Let's return to our main story now, the coronavirus pandemic. On Thursday, it was confirmed that the Hollywood actor Tom Hanks and his wife Rita Wilson have both tested positive for the virus. And while many of us are taking steps to try to limit our exposure, some of the world's wealthiest people are going one step further. I asked our reporter Charlotte Gallagher how extreme their measures are.
Incredibly extreme measures. So, Nick, we might be carrying a bit of hand sanitizer when we're out in London, washing our hands more regularly, but the rich are doing things a bit differently. You can even buy hand sanitizer for $35, and the masks that you see people wearing, you can get $100 versions. But even these really expensive items, they're sold out. You just can't buy them anywhere. But of course, then you just have this other level of wealth, the super rich, who are doing things very differently. So a company that makes bunkers says they're getting more and more inquiries for people that want to build them for themselves and their families. And these aren't basic things. They've got spas, they've got pools, they've got home entertainment systems, purified air coming inside them. So incredibly luxurious. I mean, nicer than my flat, I'm going to be honest. And these are emergency bunkers that might never, ever, ever be used. People might never go in them. I wouldn't mind living in one myself. So there's a real social difference with how people across the wealth divide are dealing with coronavirus.
Sure. And it's obviously an opportunity for a lot of people to make some money out of it.
Yeah, where some people see a crisis, others see kind of banknotes, don't they? So a private jet company in the US had an advert saying, avoid coronavirus by flying private. And as you'd expect, a lot of people were really, really unhappy with that. They said it was bad taste and just trying to scare people. But apparently the elderly, the kind of group that are most at risk of coronavirus, that group is putting in more requests and inquiries about flying private, because obviously the germs that you get flying commercial. But the advice really that all of us can follow is just be a bit more careful. Wash your hands thoroughly with soap and things like that. You don't have to go to these extreme measures. And of course, most people can't.
Charlotte Gallagher. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.